And I don't typically do this, but I just want everybody to turn around and say hi to Caleb Bowman, who's back there doing our tech this morning. Caleb, you're doing an awesome job, buddy. Thank you so much. It's always just, it's so much fun when we just have everybody participating. So, Caleb, thanks for doing that. So, Caleb, can you put up the picture, I think, that's before that slide? There you go. So we are week number two into this series called Into the Wild, which explores the wilderness experience of Israel. But the wilderness experience of Israel is not relegated to just Israel. The wilderness experience is something that all of us experience. And it's not just something we experience probably once, but it's something that we experience several times throughout our lives. And it's not something that we talk about very much. And so how do we navigate the wilderness? That's what we want to talk about, we want to think about over the course of the fall here, how we walk through the wilderness with one another, with God. What are some of the things that we're going to face? How do we face them? Since we can't do anything about the wilderness but walk through it, it's important for us to think about and think through how we move through it. And one of the questions, and the question that I want to help us think about this morning, is how we get out of the wilderness. So if you're in the wilderness, typically it's not a place that you want to be. It's not a place that you have necessarily chosen for yourself. And so one of the questions that you're asking yourself, perhaps, is how do I get out of the wilderness? So what we do to get out of the wilderness reveals something about who we are. What we do to get out of the wilderness reveals something about who we are, and who we are is impacted by where we've been. Who we are is impacted by where we've been. And part of the purpose of the wilderness is to bring us freedom from where we've been. Let me just say all that again, because I think it's an important way to think about and understand the wilderness. What we do, if we're asking this question, how do I get out of the wilderness? What we do to get out of the wilderness reveals who we are. Okay? Reveals who we are. And who we are is impacted by where we've been. And the purpose, one of the purposes of the wilderness, is to bring us freedom from where we've been. I mentioned this kind of in an aside comment last week, but I want to make sure it sinks in for us. 400 years of Israel's wilderness experience does not simply go away overnight. So they're in the wilderness, they have a wilderness experience for 40 years, which is just 10% of the amount of time that their community, the people of God, has spent in the wilderness. But 400 years of an ingrained learning of what it means to live in slavery doesn't just leave overnight. And so while we might want to get out of the wilderness, one of the purposes of the wilderness is helping us to pay attention to what has happened to us and the freedom that God wants to bring about in the things that have happened to us before we can move on to what God has for us next. We would like to get rid of these in-between times, these times when things are uncertain or kind of yucky or mucky, or we just don't have a for sure path. We'd love to get out of those times, and we think the main purpose is, well, to get from A to B, and there's really no purpose for this in-between because getting to B is the purpose. And I would suggest to us this morning that it's that this in-between time, this wilderness experience, is something for us to be very, very attentive to, because this is a place that God is really wonderful in working in, even though it's not a place that we want to be. So let's look at Exodus chapter 15, verse 22 through 26, just a very short passage of scripture. Let me give you some context of where this comes about. So Israel has just walked through the Red Sea. Most of you are familiar with this story. And so there are literally stories of water piled up on either side of them. They're walking through not on mud, but on dry land. They're crossing from this place of slavery to this other side of the Red Sea, to the other shore, to a place of freedom. And what is then drowned in the Red Sea is the oppressor, is Egypt, is their slave master. And so fast forward ahead to the New Testament a little bit, that's a sign for baptism for us. And so before we were in slavery, we moved to freedom. In the middle, there's this baptism experience where we are putting our old self to death and being raised to newness of life in Jesus. And so in Exodus chapter 14, this Exodus happens. And then Exodus 15, Moses and Miriam, the whole chapter for the most part, is these songs that Moses and Miriam sing about how God is victorious and how their enemies and their oppressors have been drowned in the sea. And so this is the very next thing that happens right after the walls of water. Okay, so keep the time in mind. You're walking through the... This is not something that is just a mental story, you know, that I'm communicating to you, but you are one of the people. If it were me and I was walking through this thing, it's like an accident on the highway. You know how everybody just kind of slows up to look, even if there's just lights that are on the side of the road, and you're wondering where this traffic comes from? And there's maybe no accident, actually, but there's just a cop that sits there and everybody just slows down. If I were going through these two walls of water, I think if I were Israel, I think the pace would be kind of slow. It'd be like, whoa, I'm just walking through this water. I think it would be kind of an amazing experience. So keep in mind that these are the very people who moments before have just walked through stories of water. And then we get to verse 22 through 26. Then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went into the desert of Shur. For 3 days they traveled into the desert without finding water. So we're talking about the time frame of days here. This is not weeks after, this is days after, 3 days. When they came to Marah, they could not drink its water because it was bitter. That's why the place is called Marah. So the people grumbled against Moses, saying, "What are we to drink?" Then Moses cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a piece of wood. He threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. There the Lord issued a ruling and instruction for them and put them to the test. He said, "If you listen carefully to the Lord your God, if you do what is right in his eyes, if you pay attention to his commands and keep all his decrees, I will not bring on you any of the disasters I brought on Egypt, for I am the Lord who heals you." I am the Lord who heals you. What I want to pick up on, first of all, is how much Israel is like Egypt. How much Israel is like Egypt. Because within what happens with this water is they test God like Egypt has tested God. So if you remember a few chapters before in the book of Exodus, we'll have God approaches through Moses, Pharaoh, and he says, "Let my people go." First time, there's no consequences whatsoever. Says, "Let my people go. There will be no consequences to your nation if you let my people go to go and worship me." Pharaoh says no, enslaves them even harder, and then the 10 plagues ensue. But each thing that happens with the 10 plagues, there's always this opportunity for the oppressor to be free from any consequences if they would be obedient to the Lord. And so eventually what Pharaoh does is falls into this rhythm. Moses comes and says, you know, this will happen if it happens. And then Pharaoh says, "If you do this, then if you relent, then I will let your people go." So Caleb, if you want to pull up the next, there you go. He's so good. Well done, my friend. So there's this relationship. There's this rhythm that develops. There's this if-then rhythm. Moitner in his commentary says, there's an element of challenge here to God, he says, demanding that he proves his worth all over again. Now keep in mind, this is a matter of days, and you just walk through water, and they're asking God to do it again. So they demand that he proves his worth all over again. If against all probabilities he gets us out of this mess, then they will consider believing. But in the meantime, they'll suspend their faith and their obedience. This if-then thing is what Egypt did. And while we might want to say, oh, Israel's special, they're different from Egypt, there's a lot of Egypt in them. There's a lot of Egypt in Israel. And the way that they're interacting with God is proof of that. God, if you do this, then I'll believe. Now, here's the thing. God works with it. You might know, or you might be a person who said, you know, God, if you do this, then I'll believe. I know stories of people where that's happened. And so we don't want to cast that down and say, you know, that's not how you should work with God. In the beginning of faith, I think it's okay. I think God's gracious and merciful and works with us where we're at. And so there's going to be some of us that say, you know, God, if you do this, then I'll believe, and God will work with it. I find this, if we think about a marriage metaphor, a lot of younger married folks, and so this was true in my marriage, we begin the relationship needing if and then. If you do this, then I know you'll love me, or you love me. And so our relationship then is based on, okay, I'm going to know my spouse loves me if they do this for me. And if I do this for them, then they'll know that I love them. But what happens oftentimes is maritally, we totally miss one another, right? And the expectations that I have for my wife or my wife that has for me are very different. And we could be trying to say the same thing, but completely missing one another. In the beginning of our marriage, it's if then. It's like I've got to prove myself to the other person. Now, Ruby and I are at 19 and a half years of marriage now, so it'll be 20 next year, which is awesome. Yay, I know, it's so... So if any of you want to send us anywhere, you know, it's fine. just saying. Brian, how about a special offering up here? I'm just totally kidding. And not. And so... But as I think about, you know, when we were raising young kids, when we were both early on in careers and those kinds of things, how much of our relationship was based off if then, and that was so tenuous. But now it's not really if, I just trust that Rube loves me. And I'm hoping, because I didn't check with her before the service, that she does too. But it's not based on proving anymore. And it's not that proving has become unimportant. But over almost 20 years, there is a trust that's developed between the two of us where we don't have to prove it to each other anymore. And so all that to say is I think it's natural in our relationships, both human and divine, for us to begin, the beginning of the relationship, to be an if-then. But you don't want to stay an if-and-then. Eventually, you want to move past if and then to a place of trust in our relationships with one another, but also in our relationship with God. So it no longer becomes, God, if you love me, then you'll do this, whatever this is. But after a while, God's proven himself to the point where you can say to God, okay, I don't know what to do with this, but God, you've proven yourself and I trust you. And there's a different security that comes about because of that, where you're not ifing your relationship with God, or you're not ifing God's posture towards you, or what God thinks about you, or how God feels about you. You're not ifing that anymore based on your circumstances. But in the midst of your circumstances, you can simply say, God, I trust you with this. And so I think it's true for all of us that in the beginning, if and then is present. And maybe if and then pops up from time to time in times of desperation, but that's not the place where you want to stay. That's not the place where I want to stay. I want to move from if and then to a place of trust. in God. And so the wilderness acts as this place, this instrument that God uses to move Israel past an Egypt kind of relationship to God, where it's just this proving back and forth all the time too, a place of trust. And so the wilderness is this place where God puts to death and transforms the Egypt, so to speak, that has roamed around in the caverns of Israel's soul for a long time. And I think it's the same for us too. If we look at the experiences that we've had that have impacted us, if we hit a place of wilderness, the wilderness is used to transform us to the things that still might hold us in bondage, those residues, those scars that we've had that have built up over the course of time. So it's important for us to understand that as Israel moves through the Red Sea, they are freed from their oppressors. They don't have to do what they tell them to do anymore because they're over them and threatening them. But the voice of the oppressor is still in their head. So the power has been demolished. And so both for Israel and the Red Sea and you and I through baptism and through the infilling of the Spirit, the power of sin and death has been demolished, but the voices of sin still kind of just are there. And so the wilderness is the place where God works those things out of us. And he does it through testing. He does it through testing. Now, an if-then relationship from our perspective towards God is kind of a test. And so we're testing God. But when we test God, we're like, if you don't pull through, then I'm done. That's not how God tests. God's test is framed, like we talked about last week, is framed between two promises. Okay? Is framed between two promises. And so God's test to us, his posture towards us, his commitment to us, does not relent if we do not uphold our end of the test. If you fail the test, when you fail the test, God doesn't, he doesn't say, I'm done with you. He is covenantal in nature. He is committed to us. He's committed to transforming us. He's committed for us to become mature. Mature. He doesn't want us to stay in this place of if and then with him, so he wants to mature us into a relationship of trust. And he does that through testing. Testing is done in a completely safe environment because God is not going anywhere. And so when God tests us, God is not moving anywhere. God's commitment is still 100% for us, but God simply wants to help us grow. Now, this test of water is interesting on a number of levels. So 3 or 4 days, Google research tells me this, you suffer from dehydration. You could die without water for 3 to 4 days. Now, what's interesting is you could have a take and a perspective that says, God, that's really super cruel. You're bringing them to the brink of death. But then there's the perspective that says, God has done, within the last 3 days, some pretty amazing things with water. So maybe I should have confidence in this, that God can do something good with this water problem that I have now. And so there's a test that takes place over water, because God's just done something truly amazing with water. And so perhaps God thinks, well, this might be a good way to grow them up a little bit. And so we're going to travel for 3 days and you're going to get thirsty. And the question is, are you going to trust me with the same element that I just used to free you from slavery? And so God uses water. It is the element at this point in their story they should be most confident in. If anything, God is the God of water. And yet it's the very thing that they're griping and complaining and they're if-thening God with. Why? Because there's still Egypt that's a part of them. There's still Egypt that's a part of them. I'm not wild about the fact that God tests, but I also can't get away from it. So I just want to share some scriptures with us this morning. These are New Testament texts. So it's not just an Old Testament thing, but God tests. So Romans 5, 3 through 5 say this. Not only so, but we also glory in our sufferings. They categorize this as sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance. Notice kind of grit's a popular word today, the grit that takes place in this progression, because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope. And hope does not put us to shame because God's love has been poured out into our hearts through the Spirit who has been given to us. I think James is next, right, Caleb? James 1, 2 through 5. Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. There's that word again. Let perseverance finish its work in you so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. And then one of my favorites, but not favorites, Hebrews chapter 12, verses 5 and following. And have you completely forgotten this word of encouragement that addresses you as children? It says, my son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline. This is supposed to be encouraging. Do not make light of the Lord's discipline. Do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines those he loves. And he chastens everyone he accepts as a child. Therefore, endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as his children. For what children are not disciplined by their father? If you are not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you are not legitimate children at all. Probably one of the most oft-quoted encouraging things that I try to speak over our church here is our sonship and daughterhood. So we are God's beloved sons and daughters in whom he loves, and in us we are well pleased. So if we are sons and daughters of God, don't be surprised then. Let not only you receive those words of comfort, but also realize that you will be disciplined. I don't know what that looks like, but I know what discipline looks like with my children. I discipline my children because I love them. I discipline my children because I want to guide them. I discipline my children because I want the best for them. I discipline my children because they don't know it all, despite the fact they think they might. I discipline at my best as a human. I discipline out of a heart of love for my kids, because I want them to grow up and mature. Testing is not the same as tempting. So James later on talks about temptation, and it's when we're dragged away by our own desires. If God wanted to tempt Israel, you can go back and look at Exodus chapter 13. We're not going to do that, but here's what happens there. God leads them through a more circuitous route. He doesn't put them into Philistine country because he says, in that chapter, he says, they will be tempted to go back to Egypt because they're going to face warfare. And so if God wants to tempt them to go back to Egypt, he could have gave them a situation that would have completely overdone it for them. But he chooses not to. God chooses not to. Instead, different route, but God does test them. God does test them. Let's look at verse 26. He said, if you listen carefully to the Lord your God and do what is right in his eyes, if you pay attention to the commands, to his commands, keep all his decrees, I will not bring on you any of the diseases I brought on Egypt, for I am the Lord who heals you. There's two things I want to draw our attention to. One is there is this possibility. Okay? It's not that God is threatening here. If you obey me, or if you don't obey me, then I won't bring on you any of the diseases that I brought on Egypt. I don't think it's threatening. I think God is saying to the Israelites, look, You can be my people, you will be my people if you follow what I give you to do and who you are to be. But if you don't, you're going to become Egypt 2.0. So it's not necessarily threatening, but it's simply truth-telling. Coming out of Egypt, they have learned the ways of Egypt. God has brought them freedom, but there is still this possibility that they are going to live in the ways of Egypt. And regrettably, over the whole Old Testament narrative, this is what we see. Egypt never really gets out of God's people. And it kind of starts, it's Egypt, and then it's Babylon, and then it's Rome, and then it's America. There's something where while God gives us the opportunity to grow and to trust, we slip back into those old patterns that enslaved us. But that doesn't have to be the case, and that doesn't have to be the way. And in order not to slip back into those things, God gives us tests. Now, next week we'll talk about another one. It was one of my favorite ones in Exodus chapter 16. But in this chapter this morning, water is just such a basic, elemental need. And just think about that basic kind of premise. Water is just something that's very basic. And that's what he starts off with. That's what God starts off with the people of Israel, is he has just done something amazing with this element. He uses this basic necessity then to test the people, whether they're going to trust him or not. They fail, that's okay. There's no judgment here. God just says, if you listen carefully. So he throws a piece of wood in there, the water becomes sweet, they drink it up, they have their Gatorade moment, whatever. And then in verse 26, if you listen carefully, there's no reprimand here. There's no, okay, look, you guys really, seriously? I just did this with water and you're still not listening? There's none of that. But if you listen carefully to the Lord your God and do what is right in his eyes, if you pay attention to his commands and keep all his decrees, I will not bring on you any of the diseases I brought on Egypt, for I am the Lord who heals you. Friends, if you want to know what to do when you're in a place of wilderness, okay, let's just start with the basics, the elemental basics like water. Okay? Make the small choices to trust. It doesn't have to be big acts of obedience. In fact, when you're in the midst of the wilderness, like, big decisions and big acts probably aren't the way to go. God's wanting to develop some elemental things in you again. And it's not, I don't think it's rocket science to know what those small things are that God has for us to do to be faithful, to trust. And so whether that's how we treat one another, whether that's how we view the wilderness that's in front of us, we can each make small steps. We can each make small steps. Jesus is very clear on this. You know, as we do the little things, this is when God continues to give us more. Dallas Willard used to say that in order to learn to do the big things, we need to learn to do the small things well. And we're so focused on the big, get me out of the wilderness, what vehicle do I got to get in to get out of this, that we neglect the fact that the shaping is actually going to come in the little things. As we trust God with the day today. So let's pray together. And then we're going to just spend a moment to worship together through song.